1 Samuel, chapter 19. Just a few remarks about the previous chapter. This 19th chapter is not difficult at all. It's just rather clear. But I do want to remind us that David came against Goliath not in his own strength, but in the Lord's. In the name of the Lord, it says. And the Lord granted that he could prevail over Goliath. As a result of this victory, you remember King Saul would not let him go no more home to his father's house. Instead, and I think a couple of you shared this with me, I really appreciate that. Instead, you will see that Saul promoted David to be over the men of war. That's stated very early in the chapter, about the fifth verse. He promoted him to be over the men of war. I think he was like the general, this young man. Also, the king's son, Jonathan, and David bound themselves together by a covenant. I think it's a covenant of friendship. Not to underestimate the fact that it's a covenant, because it was binding to them, very binding. And it was just more than friends. Let's put it that way. It's a very deeply knit relationship. Their souls were knitted together. But David, it says, behaved himself wisely. It says that four times in that chapter. That is, he prospered more. He guided himself wittingly before everyone. No matter where he was, that's what he did. But when they had returned, Saul and the others, particularly David, from the battle against the Philistines, the king became offended after he heard how the women had praised David over him. Again, you get an insight into the character of this man. It's not an understatement to say the man's unstable. He's unstable. The women had said Saul had slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Then Saul began to eye David, having suspicions about him. I'm leaning toward the idea that he seeks the kingdom. He has this insight or this feeling. In any event, King Saul had promised to reward the victor Goliath, or over Goliath, with great riches. Remember that? The marriage of his daughter, his eldest daughter, Mira, and also make his father's house free in Israel. Nothing is ever mentioned concerning David being enriched with great riches and his father's house being made free. And as you know, the marriage to his eldest daughter didn't come to pass for whatever reason. But again, you have the character of Saul being brought to the forefront. And he ends up, as a result of this praise, being offended at it, demoting David and appointing him now over to be a captain over thousands. Saul received word that his younger daughter, Michal, loved David. So again, with hope that he's thinking of ways to bring about David's death. He's done some things, and he's working toward that end. So he sees Michal loves David, so he thought maybe there'd be a way to cause him to be killed by the Philistines. And so he sets out this standard. Oh, no, you don't have to have a dowry. Just do this for me, and you can marry her. In hopes that the Philistines, he would die at the hands of the Philistines. And then we read that Saul became David's enemy continually. And we brought out the fact that that particular Hebrew verb is always translated as a noun, meaning that Saul hated him incessantly. And David became a very reputable man among the people of Israel, a man of name. And now David is forced to live the life of a fugitive. That's what takes place in the 19th chapter. Something that is through no fault of his own. So in verse 1, "And Saul spake to Jonathan his son and to all his servants, that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeks to kill thee. Now therefore, I pray thee, take heed to thyself. Be on guard until the morning, and abide in a secret place. Hide over here, and hide thyself. Come into a secret place, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art. It must have been something they customarily did. They may have went for a walk or something, but he knew that would take place. So he's got David stationed nearby in the morning while they communicate. Jonathan and Saul communicate. I'll commune with my father of thee. And what I see to perceive, that I will tell thee. And Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against thee, and because his works, what he's done, have been to thee word very good. I mean, there's no denying this. For he did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine. Notice that, referring to Goliath. And the Lord wrought a great salvation for all Israel through this man. And you saw it and did rejoice. Wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood to slay David without a cause? And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan. And Saul sware. Now that's, again, you have the character of this man, this king. That's not a good thing for anybody to do. You don't have to do this. Just make your statement. You don't have to make some kind of an oath. Because he ends up being a liar. He breaks his oath. Saul sware, as the Lord lives, he shall not be slain. And it's just simply killed. His word should have been good enough. I'll tell you what. I listened to somebody do that. I suspect that man and what he really means. When a person has to reaffirm his word, when he has to do something like this, I'm going, I wonder if he's going to keep his word. You know, it doesn't matter how many oaths you might take or make. You got to keep your word. And it's just that simple. Look, listen. If we say something, let's do that. Do it. It might cost us. But if we don't have a good name. I don't care if you're a Christian or not. You don't have a good name. It's unnecessary to make oaths of this sort and stand, and we ought to, as Christians especially, we ought to just simply state the fact. Jesus said, but let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these comes of evil, in Matthew 5:37. Is that hard to understand? No, it's very, very simple. Verse 7. And Jonathan called David, called to him. And Jonathan showed him all those things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. And there was war again. Additional conflicts took place. And David went out and fought with the Philistines. He fought for his king. He fought for the nation. He fought with the Philistines. In other words, he got his 1,000 men and he went to battle. And slew them with a great slaughter. And they fled from him, literally before his face. And the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul. And he sat in his house with his javelin. That also translated as spear, so there's really no difference in the two. With the javelin in his hand, and David played with his hand. So After this, he continued to bring relief to, supposedly, bring relief to Saul as king by playing skillfully on the harp. So here he played with his hand. And Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with the javelin, but he slipped away. He shot away from his presence, from Saul's presence, and he smote the javelin into the wall. He meant business. And David fled and escaped that night. Saul also sent messengers. Now, he said with an oath he would not kill David, but now he's changed his mind. He's out to kill him. So Saul also sent messengers right after that, evidently, and to David's house to watch him, to make sure he knows where he is, keep track of him. If he comes out, kill him. But the idea is set an ambush. In the morning when he comes out, first thing, they'd take care of business. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to slay him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If thou save not thy life tonight," if you don't flee tonight, that's literally what it's saying, "tomorrow thou shalt be slain." So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed. It's a teraphim. And I want to make a couple of remarks about this. Maybe we've not thought much about it. But Michal took a teraphim, an image. You have the idea, a pretty good size statue. And laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster, literally at his head place on the bed, and covered it with a cloth or a garment. You would think probably along the lines of some quilt. Covered up. So you have what looks like David sleeping in his bed. So you have an idea of the size of this particular image. It's life size, very likely. But I think here is reason to understand that not every image, you could disagree with me on this, but I think it's here. Not every image, or teraphim as the Hebrew is necessarily that which is considered an idol made for worshiping. I cannot imagine David, that man, having a god in his house. I find that very, very difficult to receive. So there are graven images that are not made to be worshiped. Look around your own house and think about what the scriptures say about graven images and what it means. Are we wrong in having figurines of people? We just threw one away, or I saw it out the other day. We bought it in Germany. It's a little porcelain figurine of a man chipping away at a marble bust of someone. And he's up there with his tool and he's doing that. That's a carved image. It's not a god in our house. And we have all sorts of things. We have pictures around the house. And I don't see anything about that that's idolatrous or wrong. If we don't understand it like this, then we need to go in our house and just take and dump everything that we have like that. But now some of us might have a god in our house. I don't know. I certainly wouldn't want to have a statue of Mary in my house, you know, and other things like that, or the crucifixion. I wouldn't want a thing with Christ crucified on a cross in my house, a piece of jewelry. I wouldn't want that. So it's something to think about. Not everything necessarily that is of a graven work is for the purposes of being worshipped. And I don't see this figure as such, this image. If you would turn to Exodus chapter 20, now, again, it's something you might disagree with, but if you do, I'd like to know how you will approach this. In verses 3 through 5, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Notice that that's the idea. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them. So the idea, the purpose for those would have been to bow down to them nor serve them. For I am the Lord thy God, a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers to the upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. So I think that carries the idea. They're not to be items of worship. If you would turn to Leviticus chapter 26, you have the same idea again, just to give you a couple of these examples. At verse 1, you shall make you no idols. You're talking about things to be worshipped, nor graven image, neither rear you up a standing image, neither shall you set up any image of stone in your land. Infinitive will give you purpose to bow down unto it. See, for I am the Lord your God. I want to look at one more, and that is Deuteronomy chapter 4. Read verse 15 through 19. Take ye therefore good heed to yourselves. For you saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire. Now don't lose the thought. Take good heed, lest you corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image. And then it describes all of that, those kinds of things. A graven image, the similitude of any figure, the likeness of a male or female, the likeness of any beast that's on the earth, the likeness of any winged fowl that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that's in the waters beneath them. Unless you lift up your eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the host of heaven, shouldst be driven to worship them and serve them. Whistle, and he goes on. I think that's the proper idea. We have coins with images on them. I don't see anyone getting rid of their coins. And they've got images stamped on them, and we're not worshiping. Oh, well, I know we can, but I think we should give it some thought. There were carvings. There were cherubims carved into the mercy seat. They weren't worshiping those, and those were allowed. They were in the temple. They saw those figures in the temple, and angels, various angels around. So there's nothing, as long as we're not worshiping those things. I don't know why anybody would have angels and stuff in supposedly in the house anyway. It doesn't make any sense to me. They're not a correct representation of wings and such. There's cherubim, seraphim, but other than that, I don't know that angels fit the bill. But so you have that. Now, verse 14, and when Saul sent messengers to take David, to seize him, Michal, his wife, said, he's sick, he's infirm, he's weak. And Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed, that I may kill him, slay him. And when the messengers were come in, behold, there was an image, that teraphim, in the bed, with a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster, for his head place, at that head place. And Saul said unto Michal, why hast thou deceived me? You beguiled me. You betrayed me. Why have you deceived me so and sent away mine enemy, mine hated one, that he is escaped? Why have you done this? And Michal answered Saul, her father. He said unto me, he referred to David. David said to me, let me go. Why should I kill thee? So Michal helped save her husband's life. I'll make another remark. You can certainly disagree with what I'm going to say, but I'm going to tell you where I am. Michael saved her husband's life. There's no question about it. She lied to her father out of fear, probably, of what he might do to her. After all, he's not a mentally stable person. By saying that David threatened to kill her if she didn't help him, she hoped to turn away from his wrath, the wrath of her father. Now, some will disagree, but there's going to be other situations like this where there'll be misrepresentation, purposely deceiving someone, or lying that we read in scriptures. David, for example, in 1 Samuel, we're going to be in a couple of chapters later, 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 13. David is going to pretend to be a madman when he stands before Achish, king of Gath. And David will later lie to this same king about where he's been and what he's been doing. Now, people really choke on this kind of thing. But I think Michael showed good discretion, good judgment. I'll put it like this. Some choke on the gnat of lying and swallow the camel of hatred and betrayal. For example, if there are two trails, one leads to where my brethren are meeting in secret because of persecution, meeting in the name of the Lord, and the enemies come along and they ask me which trail it was that leads to them, I'm going to lie. I'm going to lie. It's a matter of fact. Or I can betray them and show my hatred for them. Be a Judas of sorts. So you figure out what you're going to do. But that's where I am. And if you think I need to repent for that, I'll do that in a heartbeat to help my brethren. Absolutely. She did this to save her husband's life. And there's going to be other instances where we come to something like this. And I hear you kind of choking on a gnat over the matter, forgetting the important matter here, loving of a husband, love of a brethren and such. In verse 18, David fled. He got away and escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah and told him all that Saul had done. He went to Samuel, the man who said that he was going to be Israel's next king. He had confidence in this man. He is a very aged man now. There in Ramah is where Samuel lived. That's where his house was. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naioth. Now, let me spend a little bit of time here and then we're almost done. Naioth is the verb form of this. Means to keep at home. To prepare an habitation. The masculine noun is translated inhabitation. A sheep cote. That is a sheepfold, which is a pen or shelter for the sheep. Now this leads you to what Samuel had there where he lived. It means a dwelling place is translated, a fold, a stable, and a pleasant place. Naioth is located somewhere in the vicinity of the city of Ramah, obviously. We'll see that especially in verse 22. And it might be from the name of this place, there was a stable or shelter into which, as we're going to see, prophets could assemble and receive instruction. This idea of a stable or shelter carries forward with the nation of Israel, with all of the elect of God, and the churches of Jesus Christ. See, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 8, referring to the nation of Israel, you're going to find here in our reading that there's a shelter of sorts, or if at least is implied by the name of Nioth, a place for a group, an assembly of prophets to come. In this place, it would refer to the nation of Israel being such a group that is penned up by the Lord. Now, therefore, so shalt thou, the prophet Nathan, say to my servant David, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote. I took you from the pen. The sheepcote refers to the nation. I took you from following the sheep, being in the pen, to be ruler over my people Israel, to lead them. That's, you see the idea there. Then it refers to the elect of God. All of the elect of God are in an eternal pen or shelter of sorts. It's called the sheepcote. You find that in John chapter 10. Look at that. John chapter 10, you're familiar with this. And the term is, in verse 1, a sheepfold. There is a pen or a shelter into which the elect of God are kept for the coming of Christ to them. In verily, verily, at verse 1, I say unto you, he that enters not by the door into the sheepfold, into the pen where the elect are kept, into the sheepfold, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. And he's going to speak of himself, the Lord Jesus. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he puts forth his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. And finally, this term can be applied to the churches of Jesus Christ, are a special pen for the people of God. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 22. Ephesians 2, 22. The word here would be inhabitation. There is a dwelling place. That's what they are. In whom ye also are builded together for inhabitation. We could call it a special pen or a shelter, a stable of God through the Spirit. Why am I saying that? Because this is a place where David has come, Samuel is, and they have a place there nearby at Nioth, where the prophets know to come together, they assemble together. And it was told Saul in verse 19, saying, behold, David is at Nioth in Ramah. And Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as appointed over them, evidently he was leading them in their meeting together, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Maybe this is something in answer to Samuel's prayer concerning what Saul might be doing. He doesn't know until now, but it's a funny thing. The Lord interrupts or disrupts what Saul's doing by causing his messengers, when they come to this place, to begin to prophesy. At the least, we understand that their purpose is frustrated. We don't know what comes of them, but it stops. And when it was told Saul that that's what happened, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. Again, the Lord intervenes and stops these messengers from their evil task and causes them to begin to prophesy. Maybe they're just caused to speak the words of Moses, or maybe to sing them out in some way, but they did something that's called prophecy here. And Saul sent messengers again, the third time, and they prophesied also. It just ain't going to work. What are you going to do? Then went he. Saul decided, fine, I'll go myself. He went to Ramah, came to a great well. Now, I'm assuming he's coming from his hometown, Saul, I'm referring to, is coming from Gibeah and is shooting probably very direct westwardly toward the Mediterranean Sea. And along the way, there's this place noted for having this large cistern. Then he went also to Ramah and came to a great well that is in Sikhu. And he asked and said, "Where are Samuel and David?" Now, Sikhu is only named here. Matter of fact, Nioth really is too. It's named in the, this place is in the 20th chapter, I think, verse 1. And that's the only place that is not on, it's not on a map. People think they know where it is. We have an idea where these places are because of where, we know where Ramah is located. But it's only mentioned here, Sikhu. But evidently it's on the way, in between, somewhere along the way, between Gibeah and Ramah. So Saul gets to Sikhu, and something happens. He doesn't even get to Nioth at this point. And one said, "Behold, they be at Nioth in Ramah." And he went thither to Nioth in Ramah. And the Spirit of God was upon him also, and he went on. So evidently from Sikhu on, he began to prophesy until he came to Nioth in Ramah. So he is being sovereignly interrupted from his purpose, doing something he wouldn't normally do by the Lord, and frustrated in his purposes. And all of this is to give David an avenue of escape. And from this point forward, for quite some time, David is going to be a fugitive in the land of Israel. So it begins here. So he begins to prophesy, and we need to give it a little thought about what's said in the next verse 24. I've had to, in view of the context and the people present, I think it's not quite as it reads. He stripped off his clothes, his garments, his apparel. Also, when he prophesied, he did that, and prophesied before Samuel. And again, you can certainly disagree with me on this, but I'll tell you what I think I see. In like manner, as the other three groups of messengers did, and lay down, it says, naked, all that day, in all that night. One thing I want to point out, first of all, is that in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 35, we read this. "And Samuel came no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord repented that he had made Saul king over Israel." How do you reconcile this? Samuel didn't come to Saul. Saul went to Samuel. I think that's as simply as it needs to be said. There was no issue there. I had presumed when we were at this place earlier, chapter 15, that they never met again. But that's not correct. But obviously they did. And so Saul went to him. Something that you need to think about. But what does it mean for him to be naked? Well, then when you get to dig into this, it turns into a relatively broad term. The word naked as an adjective here is always translated with the English word naked. Genesis 2:25. They were both naked. Pretty clear. They're what we would call in the southern vernacular, they're stark raving naked, okay? They're as naked as a baby born, okay? Genesis 2:25. Job, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, the Lord taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So you have that idea. Very simple. But nakedness, whether it's right or wrong, it has to be, whether it is right or wrong, it has to be defined by its context. A lot of things are like that. There is a nakedness that is not sinful, and there is a nakedness that most certainly is. Nakedness might be a reference to being insufficiently clothed for the weather, or not having the proper clothing that you would normally have because you're poor. That's called nakedness, and there's no sin in that. You would have Job, chapter 22, verse 6. Thou hast taken a pledge from thy brother for naught, and stripped the naked of their clothing. They're not running around stark raving naked, but they don't have sufficient clothing for them. Job 24, 7. They cause the naked to lodge without clothing, that they have no covering in the cold. They didn't have enough clothing to protect themselves from the cold. And so the term is naked. They didn't have that. James 2, verse 15. We wouldn't understand the term as you would in Genesis, where they were both naked. If a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, you see that? So, context is a lot. It can refer to the lack of the works of righteousness. In Revelation chapter 16, verse 15, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. He doesn't have works of righteousness. He's barren in that. So he's called naked in that respect. Sinful, but he's not in a physical sense termed naked. It could be in the context of doing work. We've mentioned this before, like a fisherman at sea. In this instance, in John chapter 21, verse 7, in this instance, there's a way that men can dress when they're working together that they shouldn't dress when they're in a mixed group or in public. You see, that's proper. So you have to give that some consideration. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, referring to John, said to Peter, it's the Lord. Now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he girt his fisher's coat unto him, for he was naked and did cast himself into the sea. It can refer to the soul being unclothed of its body at physical death. 2 Corinthians 5:3, if so be that being clothed, we shall not be found naked. In other words, we're not meant to be a bodiless soul. The body or the soul is made to have a body, and it will. Even after we die, it will receive a body again at the resurrection. Obviously, it can refer to times of rebellious acts against God where people are not sufficiently, have not clothed themselves sufficiently together. Notice this, Exodus chapter 32, verse 25, and this would be a sin as well. And when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked unto their shame among their enemies. And so they weren't clothed sufficiently as the people of God. And they did that in an act of worshiping gods and such. So, to finish this verse, in this text, the Spirit of God came on Saul's messengers. They prophesied, but nothing said about them becoming naked. So what does it mean about him? Because when the Spirit of God came on him, he stripped off something. I would think that it means that he stripped off his royal garments. You know, you go, no, you're nuts. Think about this for a minute. He stripped off his royal garments, maybe his armor, perhaps his sword and things of that nature. Why do I say that? Because I seriously doubt that Samuel would have allowed that to take place among these men of God, the prophets, in their meeting place. I don't think he would have allowed it the way that we think it. I don't think he would have allowed that at all, a display of public nudity. No. I think it's better explained that he put off certain garments and was termed naked in that respect. That's my opinion. Finally, it says, wherefore they say, is Saul among the prophets? Three times this is said about him. And now David is on the run. He has had, by this that the Lord has done, he has had an opportunity to make his escape. And so we read about that over the vast part. As a matter of fact, I think we finished the book of 1 Samuel with him in that state. So there, that's the lesson. Simple as that. Thank you so much for your attention.